Welcome back to Bubble Trouble, conversations between, well, two skeptics, let's call it that. The real-life double act of the independent analyst Richard Kramer, that's me, and the economist and author Will Page, that's him. Will's new strapline is, we train on your pain. That's why we never seem to learn from past bubbles that get our portfolios into trouble. We trying, as the Who will say and sing undoubtedly on Wednesday night when Will and I go to see them in concert, not to get fooled again. But unfortunately, the tech world seems to be pretty good at fooling people. We've got a terrific guest, Bill Reduschel, to help you along with that. We'll be back with big tech versus the big state, or GovTech, in a moment.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Bill, welcome to the podcast. Welcome also to Platoon's world-class state-of-the-art studios. You'll get the full experience once we finish this conversation. But as your biography points out, you've been in this business for 60 years, and we usually like to give our guests 60 seconds to introduce themselves. So let's see if you can use all the tech compression techniques possible to compress 60 years into 60 seconds. Tell our audience about you, about the book, and very important, tell our audience where we can follow your work.
Well, you know, I'm a process of change. I started out as a chemical engineer, but chemistry is the science of equilibrium. That got me into economics. I got into doing econometrics. The software was terrible, so I started writing it myself, and I ended up being very good at writing software, and so I wrote a lot of software. Then I got into more tech, and eventually became into media, and media back in the late 70s was not seen as a tech business, but it really was. They didn't quite understand it. And then I kept becoming more and more tech, and then I ended up in the tech industry, and I was a deal guy, and I did a lot of deals. But along the way, I learned a lot of computer science. So I've evolved from chemical engineer to economist to statistician to technologist to corporate strategist.
University corridors.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, you always got to learn. If you don't learn, I think life gets boring.
I love that. And the fact that you've got out of your comfort zone so many times in your career, I think that speaks volumes for your work. Tell us a quick thing about the book there.
Well, I was John Kenneth Galbraith's last teaching associate, and he was wonderful to me. My first trip to London, he organized a lot of my meetings, which were with people who were like ministers in the government. But he taught me a lot, and I became skeptical very much. I mean, one of Galbraith's basic principles was the conventional wisdom is always wrong. And you know something? I think he's largely right. I mean, 50, 60 years later, conventional wisdom is so often wrong because conventional wisdom is comfortable and it's meeting people's prejudices and everybody can agree to it. But it's so often is just completely and totally incorrect. I mean, what I've learned in my time in tech is the laws of physics are usually right. And that if you don't follow the laws of physics, you're going to miss it. And the person who taught me that largely was Andy Bechtolsheim, who was the founder of Sun Microsystems.
Wow.
And Andy is brilliant. I mean, he's still alive. I mean, he's a brilliant guy. But what he could do is look at the laws of physics and tell you where it is. So the modern media environment, Andy laid out for me in 1988. Everything that we have today, he basically said, well, it's all going to evolve to fiber connections to the home, with gigabit plus connections, and all the content's going to be coming in over IP, and, you know, you're going to have, I mean, yes, that's what we have. And he saw that in 1988, but that wasn't based on any great bolt from heaven. It was based on the laws of physics and where the laws of physics were going to take you. So, you know, that's that. But, I mean, look, John Tukey is one of the great statisticians of all time, maybe the greatest in some people's opinion. But he had a favorite saying, which is, far better a vague answer to the right question than a precise answer to the wrong question. Mm. Because you can, after all, ask the wrong question in such a way to permit as precise an answer as you desire.
And, I love that asymmetry.
But the problem is that human beings love precise answers. And if you give someone a precise answer, so they gravitate toward that as opposed to the vague answer. And I coined Gresham's Law of Answers, which is that precise answers drive out vague answers regardless of the merits of the antecedent questions. Mm. And that happens again and again. So in the 70s, when I was doing development economics, models were all the rage. People were building models to do
pre-Excel,
development.
Pre-VisiCalc,
pre-Excel. Oh, pre-all that stuff, yeah. Right. They were building.
Now they build dashboards. Models are passé. Now it's all about dashboards.
Dashboards. Well, building these things, and they were all what economists would call partial equilibrium, which means they looked at part of the problem and ignored everything else.
I know that, the error term in a formula, right?
Yeah, and...
where you put stuff you don't know.
So my PhD dissertation was basically showing that they were all wrong. That if you didn't deal with the labor market and the bond market and the other parts of the economy, these policy prescriptions all were wrong. Because the market undid them usually very quickly. And... you know, that...
I'm sitting next to a hero. I've wanted to meet you all my life. I didn't know that you existed.
But can I pause here? Yeah. Because normally Will tells a joke, but there's a great joke which you reminded me of, which is an economist takes, or a statistician, depending on who you want to pillory, takes his son to see a giant archaeological dig. And he says, look, son, that's 1,000,008 years old. And the son looks at the father and says, wow, Dad, how did you know exactly how precisely that old that is? And he says, well, I was here 8 years ago and they told me it was 1,000,000 years old. And, you know, it's the idea of things that you can observe and count. And what I wanted to get back to is your transition from economics to tech. How have you seen tech upend those stable equilibriums that we expected in economics? Well, because a lot of what Andy Bekelstein would have laid out in 1988 wasn't a smooth path to where we are today.
I mean, if Adam Smith wrote two books. And in the first book...
another hero of Will's, by the way. A big hero of Will's.
He made a statement which is fundamental. He believed that people wanted to be loved and to be lovely. And that is how capitalism would work. People would want to be lovely. I don't think that assumption holds today. And I think the technology has made so much of neoclassical economics almost irrelevant, because neoclassical economics falls apart if there are increasing returns to scale. As you get bigger, returns go up. Technology makes everything returns to scale.
Yeah.
And the neoclassical economics does not look at the value of information. And yet information today, we know, is everything. I remember, I don't know, this had to be 30 years ago, I was at a meeting and the then director of the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency made a statement. He said, I predict that in the future, the value of the information about goods and services will be as valuable, if not more valuable, than the production itself. And at the time, that was radical.
Migration right there.
And yet, I later asked him about it. At a conference 10 years later, he said, I said that? Boy, that was pretty good.
Bill, tell me this. A lot of the conversation of the next half hour will be around this book, The New Technology State. But before we get into that, I want to hear about the book writing process. I think it's really important for our audience to recognize how authors like yourself set about the task of writing a book, getting it published, getting it to the audience. Now, you've got 60 years in the game. Did the book just spew out of you as second nature, or was there a lot of research, primary research, fact-checking to be done? Just take us through. Was it a lonely experience?
I mean, originally I started this book with my friend Tom Tuggenhat.
Incredible politician.
We went to Florence because we had to accommodate his family over Easter break. And we sat around for a week and we talked the book through. and we had an assistant there who kept the, who kept notes and transcribed it. And so we ended up laying out the book in outline. And then we just started writing it. Then he had to withdraw. And so I finished it. To be honest, I've been thinking about this book for 30 years or 40 years. I mean,
it's been bubbling.
It's been bubbling. I mean, for a long time, I was going to call it the end of robustness. I mean, if you're a statistician, you're trained that you can't have both efficiency and robustness. Mm. You can be efficient, but not robust.
I've heard that expression many times.
And not efficient. And yet, you know, we assume that we can have both. We don't. And we've made our society very fragile as a result with all the optimization that goes on. And I was a grad student, and I was working at midnight in the Harvard Computing Center. And a professor, actually at MIT, had a disaster that all of his data was on a magnetic tape, and the magnetic tape was destroyed. And he'd been forecasting weather. So he fortunately had a backup of his tape on punch cards. People really did that. And he had thousands and thousands of punch cards. And he fed them back through the computer, and all the results were different. And he said, well, where's the mistake? And they looked and looked. There was no mistake. But on the tape, the numbers were stored in binary, power of 2, and that meant they were to an accuracy of 7.1 decimal digits. Punch cards don't have a place for 0.1 digits. They only had 7. And so the difference in accuracy was 7 versus 7.1, and all the results were different. Nature seems to like what a mathematician would call nearly singular Jacobians, which means that tiny changes in inputs can lead to very large changes in outputs. And for whatever reason, whenever people build models, they almost always end up with that kind of sensitivity. And it made me very suspicious of any large model, because I understand from having built literally hundreds of models that you can tweak things and change the results.
And mid-career, we had this, of your career, we had all of this excitement about the chaos effect. And which was the exact notion that a tiny change, the flap of a butterfly's wings in Tokyo, can end up affecting the weather in Peru.
Right.
But I want to get to this concept of the new technology state, because I want to unpack the title. Are you effectively saying that the tech companies are now taking over the roles of the state? Or I can also see a plausible argument that the states, as we see them today, whether it's the NSA or the GCHQ in the UK, have to become giant technology actors themselves. I just want to get that as a starting point and understand your approach to the book.
I mean, if the government could recruit, maintain, and retain these people, the geniuses that do this work, you might get one outcome, but that outcome is impossible. The people who are brilliant, I mean, one of the key points in the book is Halstead Lane. And Maurice Halstead is a professor, he's dead now, who wrote in the 80s. He was at Purdue. And he was curious about writing software. He just tried to, what is it like? And he then looked at the people. And what has been known for decades is that the upper half a percent of developers is not twice as effective as the average. It's not 10 times. It may be 100 times more effective. And he goes, why? What is it? And what he did is he coined something which he modestly named Halstead length. The Halstead length is how big a memory chunk is. And human memory is organized into organic molecules. And you can have, on average, 7 of them open at any one time. And when something is open, you know what's in it. If it isn't open, you have to go find it and bring it back. Well, the question was, how long are these chunks? And he came up with a bunch of heuristics to measure that. What he discovered is that the average chunk for the average human being was, in his numbers, 250. And 250 was basically one page of the computer programming language Fortran. And you could understand one page. The very best programmers, the Halstead length was 65,000. So you have here an aspect of the human brain that's varying by hundreds of times. Mm. And the difference between what a person with a Halstead length of 65,000 can do and a person of 250 is just, it's incalculable, right? So, but there aren't millions of people running around with Halstead lengths of 65,000. Right. By the way, Michelangelo is high Halstead length. Beethoven is high Halstead length. Right. I mean, any of the great creative thing, that's what you need. And I don't know how government recruits them. I mean, I don't. I mean, they have terrible time. I mean, the debate, you know, I mean, believe it or not, the military services are trying to recruit them. Well, you know, the U.S. Army gave up and they said, if you want to go into cyber, guess what? You don't have to do basic training anymore.
Yeah.
The Marine Corps is still fighting about that. But I mean, the number of people who want to go to Marine Corps boot camp and are great programmers, I will tell you, those Venn diagrams don't overlap.
There's one brilliant analogy with that, which you used in another podcast, which I think is so good for our listeners. When you think about one of the greatest applications in the public realm of statistics today, which is sports.
Right.
How many people who would say, oh, I'm not good at math, but they follow these advanced analytics in all sports.
Right.
And you realize that players are valued at millions or tens of millions of dollars a pounds on the basis that they're a tiny fraction of a half a percentage point better in a very certain circumstance than their average peers. And value over replacement and all this these incredible minute differences. And here you're talking about a programmer who might be 1,000 times better than the average.
Right.
And that's just unthinkable in a sports scenario where we've all seen this regular application of analytics. Will.
Yeah, I was just, the way you were describing the government interface with tech just brought me back to 2010. I read a book called The Google Story by David Weiss. And there was this one line that I highlighted in that book, which was, Google is delivering services for the public good that the public sector could neither envisage nor deliver themselves. That was 14 years ago I read that book about Google. And I guess that captures the point of where is the brightest and best working these days? Are they going into law, banking, or accountancy? No, they're going into tech.
Well, they absolutely are. I mean, again, but it's the power of a single person, Sergey Brin, right? And Google, if you go back 20 years, there were competitors to Google. And one of the things they let you do was to put parameters around your search. And they gave you more efficient search by doing that. And people at Google wanted to do the same thing. And Sergey Brin said, no, I just wanted what people know how to do, figure out how to make that work, which is what he did, which is having an empty search bar with as few words as possible,
figure out
a way to go do it. If his organization
least had its time
way,
spent on Google, the better. That was their KPI, reduce time spent on our platform. Yahoo was the opposite, increase time spent on our platform.
Right.
We know who won the browser war.
But that was having someone like Sergey around, who is brilliant, right? You need someone like that. I mean, it's absolutely. I don't know. I mean, I was visiting the National Security Agency years ago. They were a customer when I was at Sun. And I was talking to the deputy commander, and he was telling me, he said, well, we can recruit people. We have very interesting problems, so we can get it. And I said, well, what about system administrators? And he looked at me and he goes, oh, is it terrible? He said, the government graded it as a GS-4, which is a relatively low civil service job, paying at the time probably $40,000. And I tell you, system administrator is one of those jobs that you shouldn't have. It requires somebody who's brilliant, but it's a very boring job. Now, when you take somebody who's brilliant and put them into a very boring job, the temptation to do things is very great. If you look at the two cases, I mean, Edward Snowden was the system administrator. And in order to hire him, they went to a contractor. And they were paying the contractor hundreds of thousands of dollars to hire the system administrator because the civil service system wouldn't let them hire these people in directly. And I don't know how you staff the government. I think it's one of the great challenges of the era is how do we staff government in a world? I think every business evolves to be like a sports team. And they have players and they have employees. And they're going to have to figure out how to pay, manage, and run the players differently than the employees. I mean, there are lots of employees in the big pro sports. I mean, I know a lot of the sports teams. And I don't know a lot. I know several of them in several sports. They have huge staffs.
Yep.
They're running stadiums. They've got to
marketing,
feed people. They've got marketing,
promotion.
I mean,
ticketing.
They have thousands of employees. But they have 150 players, and they pay those players very differently.
Yeah.
How does government do that?
Yeah. I know. Here's a very British example to throw at an American who's briefly visiting this country, but this country is still reeling from something we call the Royal Mail scandal. It was a drama which came out over Christmas documenting the plight of the postmasters who were sent to jail for faulty IT systems. It's been in use constantly. And you've now got those victims of the Royal Mail postal scandal saying, why doesn't the government just give the Royal Mail to Amazon to run? Tech knows what it's doing. The government doesn't. I think that kind of captures at the very heart what you're suggesting, which is where are the brightest and best? Where is the best place to run public services? I'm not saying tech should run the world. I'm simply saying, well, the state didn't do a very good job running our postal service. Maybe Amazon could do better.
Well, it all comes down to people. But, I mean, these people are not, and no offense to them. I mean, certainly in my younger years, I would be in part of it. But, I mean, they have a different set of values. They have a different set of things that motivate them. Mm-hmm. It isn't always money. It's interesting. I mean, whenever somebody says to you, what we're going to do is we are going to port this system over here. Let me tell you, the worst job in the world is porting. And none of the great programmers are going to come anywhere near that.
Right.
And you end up with mediocre people doing it, and it ends up failing because it's mediocre people, not because it's an impossible problem. It's a pretty easy problem. But nobody who's any good wants to work on it.
But it's the cold start problem, because we see this in... So I've been an analyst for 30 years looking at businesses and seeing time and again that they're stuck in the past. So if you're a bank and you have all of this legacy IT systems, the last thing that you're simply able to do is ditch it all and have a cold start in something more modern and more new. And I'm just writing about a company today. I won't mention the name, but it's a household name, but it's got terrible tech debt. It's got old systems. It's creaking under, and it simply can't move into the new world. The management gets on the conference call and talks about generative AI and large language models. They can't do any of that because they have system outages all the time.
Well,
and there's this wish that if you could wave the magic wand and just leap from the old world into the new world, it'd be great. But every business is, in a way, and even some of the biggest tech businesses are trapped in the legacy of what they've done in the past.
Including, yes, they all are.
Yeah.
I mean, look, in the U.S., the SEC is worrying about climate exposure, but you're not required to disclose tech debt.
Right.
And, I mean, I don't know if you saw the whistleblower at Boeing argues that it was tech debt that caused, in the end, caused the blowout of the plug door. Because they have very old systems, and the system which manages repair doesn't talk to the system which schedules inspections. They don't talk to each other.
This sounds a little bit like NASA and groupthink.
But Boeing, I mean, the system which managed wiring in the 707s was written in assembler on the 7094 computer, which, you know, came out when I was 40 years ago.
Yeah.
Wow.
So Boeing's solution was to go buy up dozens of 7094 computers.
And keep them running.
To try to keep it running rather than to rewrite it. Because the problem is the genius who wrote it was no longer there.
Right.
And they really probably had no idea how it ran anymore. I mean, tech debt... It's very easy, but you get the genius in. The genius creates this program. They're gone.
Yeah.
And if you think they're going to come back and help you?
Well, and by the way, they forgot to leave the documentation behind. Let me ask one question. A throwaway line I've used a lot in the past 6-7 years was the NSA and CIA, if they were really clever, would have invented Facebook and Google. And now that they are existing, they have a vested interest in continuing and letting them continue to put billions of people under surveillance every day.
So in China.
Yeah, in China, I'll give you a separate analogy for China in a minute. But do you think that is ultimately the point of control for the government over these much more proficient tech companies, that they can invoke the power of the National Security Administration and the law to say, well, if you read the Patriot Act, we come and we're going to ask you for this data and you have to hand it to us.
Well, I mean, it's the operative issue is Apple does not encrypt backups. And so they can come in and get the backup. And no matter what you've done, the backup is stored unencrypted. And therefore, the government can read it. And that was how they apparently settled with the FBI. And look, in China, it was illegal, I think it still is, to send a text message from one network to another.
Yep.
So there are 53 network, well, there are 53 provinces, 4 networks per province, so there's 212 things. But there was solutions. Solution is QQ. And you can send a QQ message to anybody. all QQ Tencent, messages, Tencent, or WeChat, all QQ messages run through Tencent in Shenzhen. And I once got off the elevator on the wrong floor in the Tencent headquarters, and the PLA people weren't very happy, and they promptly made sure that I left. But I mean, so they have every text message in China essentially flows through one building in Shenzhen, and a third of the building is occupied by the PLA.
And the same what came out in and around Snowden was that there was a splitter in a San Francisco Central Office Exchange in AT&T, which basically copied all the traffic going in and out of the U.S. and siphoned it to the NSA. So they could get literally a copy of every single bit of data going in and out of the U.S.
That's right.
On the West Coast and presumably on the East Coast as well.
AT&T, they didn't have every network.
No.
And Lucent built that for them. And it was a secret project. And they didn't think it was possible, but it was.
So do you think the government can still retain some measure of control over big tech? Or do you think big tech has the upper hand now? That's where the real question that we've been wrestling with for over 100 episodes on Bubble Trouble.
Well, I mean, there are 200 startups in Ukraine making autonomous drones. And U.S. policy is that no drone can kill autonomously. Well, the problem is in the Ukraine, the Russians are jamming the radio waves. So if the drone has to get permission to fire, it'll never get permission. And so, therefore, the Ukrainians have to take U.S. stuff and modify it so that it can kill autonomously. But they're 200 startups. I mean, it is getting easier for people maybe on the edge to go do that. But could they build the infrastructure that's there? I mean, if you come to Northern Virginia, this is where the internet started, that's where AOL started. Today, it's just nothing but data centers and data centers. Hmm. And we're running out of power. I mean, people are saying that AI alone is going to be an 8%, 10% increase in the drain on the power grid. At the same time, we're trying to shut down coal plants and natural gas plants. We're trying to grow it. And oh, by the way, if every car becomes electric, you need a 25% increase in electricity. You can't do it. It doesn't solve. So I don't know how you assemble the talent, do the project. I spent a lot of time working with the government, for the government, never as an employee, but as a contractor. And there's all these things that mitigate against it ever being successful.
We'll be back in a minute with Bill Reduschel and talking about big tech in the state and a ton of fascinating topics. Back in a moment.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back to Bubble Trouble, part two of Bill Reduschel, whose fantastic book is just out, The New Technology State. And we're speaking to a guest who's got 60 years of experience in debunking economics, from what I can understand. And Bill, to kick off part two with a very quick joke about economics, you cracked one in part one. So this is another Bill telling a joke in part two. I always liked the expression I was told, which is the problem with economics is when an economist builds a model and the consumer doesn't behave like that model would have predicted, the economist blames the consumer for being wrong. I always think that's a lovely way of capturing where economics often finds itself on the hard shoulder these days. Now, in part two, we like to go down a rabbit hole with a deep topic and see where it takes us. Richard, take us down that rabbit hole.
Yeah, I guess where I wanted to start off, following on from when I was the honor to be on a panel at the FT Weekend Festival this autumn, I was pointing out a difference that I saw between the U.S. and China. And I think China sensibly looked at the U.S. and said, we don't want to have a bunch of unelected tech billionaires telling us, the government, what to do. So they took the highest profile one and effectively disappeared him. That was Jack Ma from Alibaba. And we talk a lot in Bubble Trouble about regulatory capture. about the fact that we have these bubbles, but we only find out about them after the fact, and whether that's in the finance world or the tech world or wherever, that the regulators seem asleep at the switch. You've looked at this from the executive suite, from looking at from governments. Do you feel that regulatory capture, Stigler's theory, explains everything and why we see these recurring problems? Or do you think there is a role that, as the EU is trying to do very actively right now, that governments can get on top of tech and bring it to heel somewhat?
Well, it gets back to my earlier observation about government and talent.
Right.
I mean, I went to a presentation on the Biden administration's policy on regulating AI. And it was basically creating fear and then using that fear to justify industrial policy or social policy with absolutely no idea of how to do it. We're going to make AI be gender equal. It's software running on. It all comes down to, I can make it do whatever you want, but then it's not, how do you regulate that? I don't know how you do it. On the other hand, I'm going to give a talk next week on humanity versus software, because I think that is the issue of the day, and how do we control it? But there's nobody. You go into Congress, there's no software developer in Congress.
No.
You can't lead if you don't know where you're going.
Nice. That is a terrific phrase. That's the title of our podcast.
But a year where a billion people go to the polls to vote, that's a wonderful slogan.
I don't know who, I just don't know who is going to do it or how you do it. I propose some remedies. One of the things that I would do, is I would impose a tax on market capitalization. So that the bigger you got, the higher and more expensive it was to stay big. And if you wanted to split yourself up, you could save the tax.
Right.
Because you could do that and not necessarily hurt the shareholders.
Wow, that's self-regulation personified.
Yes, it's self-regulation. And that's much better because,
I never heard that before.
And that's what I would do, is I would tax market cap so that these companies would have to divide themselves out and figure out a way to do it, because I believe that you get more innovation. When I was at Sun, Bill Joy was the founder, and I spent a lot of time with Bill. And Bill had a fundamental law. And his law was, the number of great people in any organization is proportional to the log of the number of employees. The logarithm. Okay, so the logarithm goes up much more slowly than does the number. And it wasn't...
So that's why you have a lot of tech companies with a lot of dead wood?
Yes. Startups are a compensation response. They're not... Startups aren't required for any other reason other than that's how you get paid money. You figure out the way you get paid what you're worth is you go form a startup.
I will take a slightly different view, which is, I think what we've seen time and time again, and you've seen this in an industrial scale with companies like Cisco, where groups of people engineers would figure out the product the company needed, leave, build that product, and sell it back to the company because the company was so hidebound. I think startups also exist for a degree of freedom. And I can only imagine for the literally millions of people working for large tech companies, and it is millions all told. The Googles of the world only have 180,000, and you go on from there. But for a lot of them, what they really want is to work with a couple of friends on one really hard problem and not have all the superstructure, the HR, the compliance, the finance, all the stuff around them. So I don't think I think the compensation response is one part of it. But I think, as you said, a lot of people are not motivated just by that money.
If you're a great creative programmer, you probably don't want to work in a bureaucracy.
Yes.
And
you want to solve hard problems.
And you want to solve hard problems and you want to go off and you don't need a big team to go do it.
The greatest example of a bureaucracy, a friend of mine recently quit the BBC, big national institution, employs a lot of people. And I said to her, how did you quit the BBC? She said, because I worked out that my job description read, I meet, therefore I am.
Well,
spent her entire day in meetings from start to finish, no work.
The success of Google, a large part of it goes back to a friend from Sundays, Wayne Rosing. And Eric Schmidt hired Wayne to be the first VP of engineering at Google. He came in, and on his first day, there were 1,400 programmers at the time and 140 middle managers. So the first thing he did was fire all the middle managers, wow, send them away, and then said to the programmers, you know what to do. And he organized them into teams of 10 to 20 people.
Squads and
they became self-organizing. And all the great innovation at Google came because you basically let the engineers go
Bill,
off.
You are dropping knowledge on this podcast.
And that is what...
Fire-hosing middle management.
Now, I mean, there's... They still have this. I mean, they eventually put an administrator into each group, and the administrator ideally was an engineer with an MBA. And I think, without getting... treading into tenure, they preferred women for these roles because they worked better in the environment at the time. I don't know. But, I mean, that was how Google... It gets very hard when you have to start coordinating across all these groups that are all used to being autonomous. Mm. And suddenly...
Aligned autonomy. I've heard that expression in tech, aligned autonomy.
I mean, alignment... Look, alignment is the hardest problem management always has. Mm. And trying to get people aligned is... I say a CEO has four jobs. Awareness, attraction, architecture, and alignment. Mm. Know what's going on in the world so you're in the right place. Attract money and capital and talent into your organization. Figure out what the structure is and who can do what, and then make sure that everybody is going roughly in the same direction. Mm. If you try to get them going exactly in the same direction, you're going to kill everything. Mm. The key to success is slack. If there's no slack in an organization, there's no innovation. Mm. Because you kill the question prematurely. If the question isn't mature... and you ask it and you demand an answer, it's going to die. And you know, that, you know.
Back to Google giving you Fridays to explore stuff, your passion projects.
Freedom, like go off and experiment. When I have an idea, it's probably not ready for prime time, but it takes a little bit of work. But if I prevent that, I mean, so if you go to get an MBA from any business school in the world, is any good, the first thing it's going to teach you is the first thing you do is eliminate all slack. And then they say,
that's a great investment, learning that rule. $80,000 down the drain.
If I see a company that has a VP of innovation, I'm always very suspect.
Because Bill, real quick. Richard went down one rabbit hole, which is regulatory capture theory. I want to go down another rabbit hole, which is...
By the way, the big companies want to be captured. Because then that'll be a barrier to entry, and nobody else will be able to come in and compete with them. And that's what they want, is they want the regulation, because the regulation basically would enshrine them as the keepers of this.
Yeah, so. I think of it slightly differently, in the sense of they've captured the regulators because, as we saw in the comical, I call them kabuki theater hearings in the Senate, when Mark Zuckerberg has to explain to an 80-plus-year-old senator from Utah that they sell ads. Mm-hmm. That's how they make money. Mm-hmm. And it's just so basic. And, of course, you know that at the end of it, nothing, 40 hearings, and there's been no regulation of social media in the U.S.
Well, how do you regulate social media? I mean, that's that. So you can build AI bots that are going to read everything, but then that means we become the master, whoever programs the AI bots, and who knows who they are, and who knows what training materials are selected. I can make an AI bot do almost anything. If I pick the right training materials and the right clues and the order, I can guarantee the outcome, and I can sit there and say, oh, the software did it, not me.
Let's move from regulatory capture to what I like to call regulatory fatigue, a separate rabbit hole, which is the regulators always seem to be late to the party. Like, something happens, and 7 years later, 9 years later, the regulator says, we're going to have an investigation. We're going to publish a PDF report. It's going to have 250 pages that nobody seems to read. The regulation often seems, the horse is bolted before you can lock the stable, is the expression that we use over here. Our own regulator, Ofcom, was once described to me as, Ofcom is forever regulating companies that are trying to put themselves out of business. They don't regulate the new world, they regulate the old world. Now, you may want to offer a few spoilers from your book here, but, you know, do you see the sort of fatigue issue being a problem, the time it takes, the gap, and is that gap widening between event and action?
It's just talent. I mean, you can't... Look, I mean, we're living in a world in which there are very few people that are in a job where they are not going to be obsolete within 10 years, in many cases obsolete within 5 years. And government doesn't have the turnover and doesn't have the ability to refresh to go do that. When one of the things we did at Sun, and, you know, I did it, actually, is we went out to the employees and we said, we no longer are managing your career. We will tell you where we think the employment opportunities are, but managing your employability is your problem. We will give you help. We will provide courses. We will provide advice. But your job is you own your employability.
It's interesting.
And we provide you with what we predict are the jobs. And if you no longer fit, we'll give you a humane exit. And that's the way everybody has to be. It's not the way the government is. And because of that, I mean, I got dragged into a crypto dispute with the SEC. And I was completely innocent. And they eventually still cost me $100,000 in legal fees. Because in the first conversation, they said, as customary practice, oh, by the way, we're not putting you under oath. We're just trying to figure out what's going on. By the way, sign this form. And it says, this conversation is subject to 18 U.S.C. 2001, and which says that every misstatement is punishable by a $25,000 fine and 2 years in prison. So it's not really a casual conversation. They were great people. They were wonderful people. But they had no idea what's going on in the crypto world. And I don't know how do you manage government in that way? I mean, by the time you're a senior civil servant, you're 20 years into your career probably. And very few they're not required. No, they aren't any organization to keep current. And what they have to regulate may not have existed when they went to school or in the first 5 years. So, I mean, there's a real problem of how do we staff government? And regulatory fatigue, I think, is just...
I've always said that. You study at university that a monopoly contracts supply and jacks up prices. Companies expand supply and erode prices. We can talk about monopsony, but the monopoly definition doesn't fit the way the game is currently being played.
I mean, but it's just Moore's Law. I mean, Moore's Law is 30% a year, and that's 97% a decade. And so things which were impossible a decade ago are cheap today, and 97% is a lot. What makes AI feasible is that the computers are faster, storage is less, and the internet did a wonderful job of putting all that information into an accessible form. So you could take OpenAI. Apparently they used a search tree that they got from an offshoot of the PLA, according to a rumor, and they just went and grabbed everything they could. So now it's feasible, but it's the laws of physics that made it feasible. If you'd sat down and thought about it, you would have gone, well, about this time. And now NVIDIA is trying to make it cheaper. And there are startups out there that claim they're going to be 20 times
cheaper. But with that, and just to follow on from Will's point, you've just passed a major AI law in Europe. Now, one of the things we have discussed previously on this podcast with several guests is this old saw, and it's a bit lazy, but to say the U.S. innovates, China copies, and Europe regulates. But Europe, in this case, is trying to regulate in real time and potentially in advance of the problem. Do you think there's any better solution there? Or
and Japan is saying, okay, copyright's going to be an obstacle, so we're going to make training a fair use in Japan so that you can do it. Because Japan says, we're short labor, AI can save our bacon, so therefore, let's do everything in our power to make it. Yeah. I don't think you're
somebody
going to see...
Somebody breaks rank.
Yeah, I mean, it's a different attitude. I don't know. I mean, I was at a company, and we suddenly the CEO got a phone call, and he had to file a lawsuit by 5 o'clock. It was 2. But it was worth it because the person calling was the judge assuring him that we would win, and as they did. But that's the difference between Europe and the U.S. That case would have taken forever. But we don't regulate programmers. So how are you going to regulate what they write? I just think it's all nonsense. It's public.
You're taking your mind off the outcomes and going into the machine room itself. It's like outcomes.
It doesn't matter where the software is written. I mean, somebody put out a fake post about a startup that was going to take 10,000 GPUs and anchored them on a barge in international waters, like the pirate radio stations of the 70s. And so what are you going to do then? And the world is interconnected by fiber. And in another 15 years, you're going to be able to run the equivalent of ChatGPT on your phone. You certainly are not chasing where the puck is going. You're chasing where the puck was, which is not a very fruitful, but they think they can do it. I mean, you can regulate something that you know.
So,
Bill, before we get to smoke signals, I want to bring you back to where you began studying at Harvard, and particularly your studies of econometrics. When I think about what you study at university when you take a subject like economics and what you see in reality when you enter the real world, there's a bit of a gap there in terms of from theory to practice. If you wanted to be good at economics today, if you wanted to be good at understanding the world, what subjects would you recommend that student, 18, 19-year-old, goes to study at university? What disciplines are needed now compared to what disciplines you studied then?
You know, what it turns out, economists are very good at figuring out what questions to ask. And as all the data has been collected, I mean, Amazon went off and hired a whole bunch of 140, I think, PhD economists a couple of years ago because they had the data, but they didn't know what questions to ask of the data.
Yeah.
And the economists were good at doing it. Economics is the science of trade-offs. Mm-hmm. Trade-offs are the world. So any place you got trade-offs, economists training should help you in figuring out what questions to ask of the data. And that, I think, is important. But look, I think professions, the mean time to obsolescence or the half-life of professional training is probably 5 years now.
Well, and at the very start, you said the trade-off you learned was robustness and efficiency.
Yeah.
In Europe, we say fairness or efficiency. Might be a nice little transatlantic thing going on there.
Well, yeah, but I have a friend who firmly believes in double bottom line companies. They've all failed. Mm-hmm. Because you can't, there is no such thing. I mean, human beings don't optimize two things at once. First of all, it's mathematically impossible. So that's one reason why they don't, but they don't. You know, and you tell people what to do. I mean, I suggest that one of the things we should maybe do to help ourselves in this world is abolish incentive compensation because it encourages people to go and find all these little tweaks that make life miserable.
Sure.
And don't look at the longer term. I mean, in 1923, Frank Ramsey introduced the idea of social discount rate. And what is the rate at which one generation discounts the welfare of future generations when it makes decisions? And Ramsey argued 100 years ago, it should be zero. Pope Benedict argued 10 years ago, it should be zero. Today, it's probably 35%.
Or more.
And
we have a climate crisis, you'd argue it's a heck of a lot more, and certainly in the last 40 years.
A heck of a lot more and growing. Now, Bill, we like to wrap up the show with something called smoke signals.
Okay.
Where we simply ask our guests to toss out to our audience, for the benefit of 60 years of experience that you bring to this show, just a couple of warning signs, like headlines that make you cringe.
Things that make you go, when you hear that, you go, oh, that's just not going to end well.
Where you need a rubber desk because you're banging your head against it. Like stuff that you hear governments toss out as ambitious new policy initiatives. Can you give the audience, from 60 years of experience that you bring to this microphone right here, just a couple of smoke signals that are going to help them not get fooled again?
I mean, I was listening to a person, an AI expert talking, and he said something that I had listened for a second and go, yep, you're right. He said, in the next 5 years, every piece of software has to be rewritten because of AI, because it's going to change the user interface. AI is a new abstraction layer. And every time you get an abstraction layer, the desktop was an abstraction layer, the phone was an abstraction layer, the web is an abstraction layer. Every time you get an abstraction layer, it lets another group of people get everything underneath. And AI is now going to be an abstraction layer on top of this whole computing stack that's there. And every application is going to have to get rewritten. Are they going to get rewritten well? I don't know, but it means that anybody, any incumbent, I mean, I remember when the world was VisiCalc. I remember when the world was Lotus 1-2-3, and
Mitch
then
Kapoor.
It became Excel, right? I mean, it doesn't take very long for a dominant player to get knocked out when you change the nature of the user interface and where it goes. And so I think that looking at every player and saying, healthcare, I mean, doctors hate dealing with Epic. I mean, Epic is everywhere. They don't like it. They hate it, but they're using it because there are rules and regulations that make them do so. But, you know, all the software is going to get rewritten. And so I think that you look at that and go, it's pretty hard to guess exactly how that all shakes out. And the second thing I would go to is electric power. We talked about it a minute ago. I mean, you can't do all that. I mean, the brain is about 50 watts. AI is not 50 watts. I mean, Tesla is moving its AI computing plant to Buffalo, New York, next to Niagara Falls, because they're looking for cheap electricity.
Wow.
But, I mean, you're talking about incredible amounts going in. And one of the challenges with search is Google has spent 20 years making search really efficient and really cheap. AI isn't efficient and cheap. And so if you make it AI-based, it's going to be a lot more expensive. And I don't know what Google's business model looks like then, because there are going to be fewer searches, and they're going to cost a lot more money, and then less opportunity for advertising. That doesn't sound like
That's a strange trajectory.
It's not a good trajectory. So I think electric power is that. But I see consumer rage. I mean, people, you go on and you get one of these automated attendants, so they'll become better. And it's possible that if it's ChatGPT or Gemini or Claude or whichever one you want to pick, Lambda, you'll get better interaction with this like interface. But I think consumers don't understand it. They get what they and their lives are increasing. I mean, we've never taken a technology that is this complicated and spread it out among so many people.
So quickly.
I mean, I sit and listen to people at airports or things and someone is explaining technology to someone else. And it's almost humorous. I wish I could record it discreetly because they have neither party has any idea what they're talking about. And yeah, but we forced it on them. I mean, you can't have a family. You can't have social life. You can't have a job unless you master and understand this technology.
I think that's a great spot to wrap up on. I think we as a society are going to spend the next decades trying to wrestle with that. And equally, I've had my own experiences with that consumer rage. Press 1 to get annoyed, press 2 to get frustrated, press 3 to have a hang up on you and start the whole process over again, or press 4 to listen to the worst hold music you've ever heard to talk to a human being. Mm-hmm. Bill Reduschel, I'd like to thank you very much for bringing 60 plus years of experience. I can only imagine, it doesn't seem like you're slowing down in the slightest, and I'm very eager to read. I don't think it's actually been published here yet, your book with Tom Tugendhat.
No, it is. Yeah? In December, yeah.
Okay, we weren't able to lay our hands on one physical copy. Yeah. But we'd love to have Tom Tugendhat on the podcast as well. Unfortunately, he has bigger fish to fry for a little while, at least longer, while he's still in the UK government. So thank you very much. You've name-checked literally all of Will Wage's sort of heroes, including Adam Smith, who I've seen the photos from him visiting his grave in Edinburgh.
Yeah, but isn't it Adam Smith's grave to prove that economics is dead and buried?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm sure he'd be happy to take you there anytime. So it's been a great episode of Bubble Trouble, and thank you very much for coming by Platoon.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. If you're new to Bubble Trouble, we hope you'll follow the show wherever you listen to podcasts. And please share it on your socials. Bubble Trouble is produced by Eric Newsom, Jesse Baker, and Julia Nett at Magnificent Noise. You can learn more at bubbletroublepodcast.com. Until next time, from my co-host Richard Kramer, I'm Will Page.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.